This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up on Playing with Food, local farmers are giving school lunches a complete makeover, thanks to a relatively new program of Farm to School.
We sometimes will even collaborate with the districts close by to do like one large group order to help the farmer out, and then it helps us out too.
And the Santa Barbara City Council recently voted to cap the number of cruise ships visiting Santa Barbara annually.
We also wanted requirements that the cruise ships that do come to Santa Barbara use advanced wastewater treatment systems. So this is new technology that's come on board primarily in the last 20 years.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 20th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. California's Central Coast is the ancestral homeland of indigenous California tribes, including the Chumash and Salinian peoples. For years, the Northern Chumash have been working to create a new marine sanctuary. If the federal government approves that designation this summer, California will be home to its first national marine sanctuary nominated by and named after an indigenous tribe. It's the culmination of decades of tribal conservation work. And as reporter Benjamin Perper tells us, it's also the legacy of a father and a daughter.
So here in California, of course, we're famous for our spectacular beaches. But did you know that our stretch of the Pacific is home to more species of plants and animals than almost any other coastline in the country? I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. Today we're going to start our show on a magnificent stretch of the Central Coast, where you can sometimes spot endangered or rare species like gray whales or peregrine falcons or sea otters. This is also the ancestral homeland of indigenous California tribes, including the Chumash and Salinan peoples. For years, the Northern Chumash have been working to create a new marine sanctuary here. If the federal government approves that designation this summer, California would be home to the first national marine sanctuary nominated by and named after an indigenous tribe. It's the culmination of decades of tribal conservation work. And as reporter Benjamin Perper tells us, it's also the legacy of a father and a daughter.
I first met Violet Sage Walker when I witnessed a once-in-a-lifetime ceremony back in August 2022. It was at the base of Morro Rock, a towering 600-foot-tall volcanic rock off the coast of San Luis Obispo County. It's sacred to local indigenous tribes, including the Northern Chumash, who call it Lisimu. Violet was wearing an eagle feather on her hat, singing traditional songs on the beach with a group of Chumash women as men rowed to shore in wooden boats called tamals. I watched as she and other tribal members helped hoist the tamals onto the sand.
Keep her low now. Let's get her low.
Bring her down. Bring her down.
Let's get her low.
The ceremony was called Reunite the Rock, and that's exactly what it did. Over the last two centuries, Morro Rock was blasted for building materials, losing about a third of its total mass. All that rock went to buildings around the Central Coast and a nearby breakwater. On that hot August day, the Northern Chumash brought back sacred rocks reclaimed from the breakwater and reunited them with Lisimu. In some ways, it was a solemn act of restoring ancestral territory that was taken from them. But for Violet, the theme of the day was celebration and unity. She passed out traditional necklaces to both Chumash and non-Chumash people alike.
And this is a rock effigy of Morro Rock, Lisimu. And it represents our rock and our ocean and our people and our food and our energy and our love. Let's get you all wearing one right now.
Almost 2 years later, I got to take a closer look at one of the tamals used in that ceremony in Violet's garage.
There she is.
Wow.
It's a small wooden boat she calls the Little Sister. She says it's symbolic of her people's centuries-long relationship with the ocean.
The original scientists were the native people. You know, they knew everything about the weather, the seasons, the wind, the water temperature, currents, rain, erosion, all this stuff.
For Violet, the proposed Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary is a continuation of that ancient legacy. She says it wouldn't just protect endangered species and the marine environment from things like offshore drilling, it would also help the tribe preserve their history and culture.
Part of our mission as the tribe is restoring and doing a lot of work with our youth and bringing back these traditional practices, cultural practices.
Violet is now the chair of the Northern Chumash Tribal Council. It's a title she inherited from her father, Chief Fred Collins, who died in 2021. He was famous for his environmental activism around the Central Coast. He's the one who had the vision to reunite Morro Rock and to propose a new national marine sanctuary in the first place.
This is a legacy that I intend to leave here, that we have our children will never see oil drilling going on, fracking off of our coast.
That's Fred at a renewable energy conference in 2015, the year he proposed the Chumash Sanctuary to the federal government.
But this issue here is so big that we need another layer of protection so that my grandsons and my great-grandchildren won't see oil wells off of our coast here.
His idea was to join together these waters with the existing Channel Islands and Monterey Bay sanctuaries to create one continuous 20,000 square mile stretch of protected ocean. I'm out at Morro Rock with PJ Webb, who works with the Northern Chumash Tribal Council. She's their legal advisor, and she helped Fred draft the proposal for the sanctuary. We're looking at one of the Central Coast's most iconic endangered species, the southern sea otters in Morro Bay.
Oh, look at, she has a baby. She has a pup on her stomach.
PJ is pretty familiar with these cute little creatures. She used to help rehabilitate sick otters, where she learned how to do this.
Nice.
Okay.
That was great.
For PJ, the otters are a symbol of the rich ecosystem in Morro Bay and the rest of the Central Coast.
One of the places where southern sea otters raft together is right there. We only have around 3,000 southern sea otters, the whole species.
She worries about what could happen to the sensitive environment if it's not protected from development.
It's a vulnerable place, and right now it's pretty pristine. And we need to keep it that way because it generates so much life. The ocean is the solution to global climate change, and we have to treat it and respect it as such.
After PJ and Fred Collins submitted their proposal, the feds agreed to consider it and sent scientists to evaluate the area. After a lot of study and public input, they pretty much accepted Fred's blueprint to conserve this stretch of the Pacific coast. When he died in 2021, it seemed like he'd get his wish. But then, last fall, the government proposed a change, a counterproposal, which would remove the Morro Bay area from the sanctuary boundaries. It would leave a gap of a few thousand square miles of ocean out of federal protection, including Morro Rock, which is so sacred to the Chumash people. I asked Paul Michel about this. He's with NOAA, the federal agency leading the sanctuary process.
This is a busy coast.
He says they've worked hard at listening to feedback from all kinds of ocean users and balancing their interests. One concern is renewable wind energy. Three companies now have leases to put massive floating offshore wind turbines into the waters off Morro Bay. That would require installing a lot of underwater cables to get that energy back to shore.
We looked at that and thought that might be just too much industrial development within a national marine sanctuary.
Michelle says the gap in the proposed boundary is just one possible solution to balance critical renewable energy needs with the conservation goals of the Chumash tribes. Initially, some tribal members didn't like the idea of leaving this gap in the map. But last month, the tribal council got together with the three offshore wind companies to ask NOAA for a phased approach. Basically, they recommended leaving a gap in place long enough for the cabling to get done, and then expand the sanctuary to include Morro Bay. Violet says it's a compromise.
You know, no compromise. It makes, you know, everyone come out perfectly happy, or else it wouldn't be a compromise. But I think that this shows that we're able and willing to work together. And we really need to focus on what we're doing, and that is protecting the planet and protecting the ocean.
She says this is the best way forward to get the sanctuary designated this year and eventually expand the boundaries to protect an unbroken stretch of ocean. Offshore wind farms have never been built on the West Coast, so it isn't clear how long this whole plan would take. But if the feds agree, it would pave the way for Fred Collins' vision to eventually come true.
This has been decades in the making, and I'm the third generation to work on this. And so I'd just like to say that I think that after a long period of contemplation, that my dad would be proud of this compromise and this collaboration.
Back at Morro Rock, PJ Webb says these waters weren't just a conservation project for Fred. They held emotional and spiritual weight. When Fred died in 2021, the Chumash held a ceremony for him in these waters. They placed his ashes in a tamal and rowed it into the sea.
It was triumphant. It was something that I may never see again in my life. It was just a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it was special because this was one of Fred's favorite places. And to have all these different Chumash elders come out here and hold ceremony was very, very moving.
It was a good ceremony for my dad. It was worthy of his stature.
Back at her home, Violet is showing me photos of her dad in a book she's printed.
Shoot, this is probably my dad's most famous picture in front of the ASMU, in front of Morro Rock. He said he looked better than Tom Cruise.
Violet says her work with the Marine Sanctuary is a way to honor her father's vision.
One of the last things he told me, like, he was on his deathbed, literally, and he said to make sure that I tell people that the Marine Sanctuary is the most important thing he ever did in his life.
Violet says no matter what, she and other tribal members are going to keep working to preserve their ancestral ocean and her dad's legacy.
That was reporter Benjamin Perper. This summer, the federal government is expected to officially approve what's likely to be called the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary, protecting a stretch of the Central Coast. It's still not clear just exactly what the boundaries will look like and whether Morro Bay will be included.
This is KCBX Public Radio. You are listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Climate scientists expect more heat waves to hit the Central Coast in the coming years, which could put people's health at risk. This week on our series, The Heat Beat, Beth Thornton reports that taking precautions can save lives and minimize visits to the ER.
The emergency room at Marion Regional Medical Center in Santa Maria is a busy place most every day. But on extreme heat days, when temperatures are unusually high, Dr. Terrence McGovern sees a lot of patients with heat-related illnesses.
We definitely see an increase in our volume for heat-related illnesses when we have significant heat waves that come through our area.
McGovern is the ER medical director at Marion. He describes a spectrum of heat illnesses, from muscle cramps to heat exhaustion with fatigue and profuse sweating, to heat stroke, the most serious condition.
Heat stroke is typically characterized by some sort of neurologic involvement, people not acting themselves, acting erratically. People are not sweating, which is very concerning and can be a life-threatening condition.
He says to call 911 if you think someone is showing signs of heat stroke. The prevalence of heat illness is not closely tracked at the local level, but McGovern says that the elderly and young children are especially vulnerable. Also, people who work outdoors.
When we have these heat waves and we try to do the same amount of work at the same pace under worsening conditions, it definitely puts them at higher risk for developing one of these heat-related illnesses.
The Central Coast region grows much of the nation's fruits and vegetables, and farm workers are often in the fields during peak hours. By California law, farm workers must have access to water and time to rest in the shade. But working long shifts on hot days can lead to heat-related illnesses. Dr. Penny Borenstein is the public health officer for San Luis Obispo County. She says as temperatures rise, state and local agencies must continue to find ways to reduce health risks for agricultural workers.
Some of the lowest income people who do our farm labor are at highest risk because if they don't work, they don't get paid. So trying to work with employers to make adjustments for those situations.
Borenstein says heat waves affect the whole region. But slows North County, she says, can hit triple digits for long periods of time.
Many of us in many parts of the county do not have air conditioning, but even in the North County, where it's almost the norm, people in lower income housing often may not have air conditioning, and so they are at risk for really suffering.
She says the county is working on a plan to get better prepared and create more resilient communities.
Some programs that are coming to bear that can provide for some air conditioning or cooling systems, or even just shades or mister systems in, you know, the homeless areas. Those are starting to become available, but we don't have anything right at this moment.
If you don't have air conditioning, Bornstein suggests going to a store or library to cool off, even if it's just for a short time. And remember to check on your neighbors, she says. Back at the ER, Dr. McGovern has more advice for staying safe on hot days.
The prep work for it is being well hydrated before you go out, wearing light, loose-fitting clothing, wearing sunscreen, wearing a hat to provide some barrier between yourself and the sun.
And he says if you do feel symptoms of heat illness, stop what you're doing and put a wet cloth on your skin.
And get yourself in shade, start cooling off sooner rather than later. And never leave a child or pet in the car in the heat or at any time.
Next week on the Heat Beat, you'll hear about a nonprofit that helps low-income residents and seniors repair their homes to make them more weather-resilient. For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
Our series, The Heat Beat, includes conversations with health professionals, local officials, and nonprofit organizations as heat-related projects get underway on the Central Coast. Later this week, on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, The Heat Beat will focus on a nonprofit that helps low-income residents and seniors repair their homes to make them more weather-resistant. This project is made possible by a grant from the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, playing with food.
I got in the strawberry and then mix it, and then it will turn like that color, but not that fast. And then it will turn like that.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. Oh, the sounds of happy, healthy children. It's lunchtime at Lillian Larson Elementary School in San Miguel. After a morning of diligent learning, the children dine al fresco with an array of local produce to restore their bodies, minds, and souls so they can play and laugh and sing and shout and learn and grow. Thanks to a relatively new program of farm to school, their lunches don't as much arrive in large refrigerated trucks that started their journey halfway across the country. Instead, local farmers stop by to drop off freshly picked, locally grown fruits and vegetables, freshly baked bread, and kumquats. Sounds too good to be true? Not on the Central Coast. The farmers around here are giving school lunches a complete makeover, and we start on one of those farms atop a hill overlooking Morro Bay. Just a note, for the first minute, that squeaky sound in the background is the kids' remote-controlled car.
My name is Claire Tuimote, and I'm the farm-to-school coordinator for Slow Money San Luis Obispo.
My name is Lauren Thomas, and I'm the food service director for San Miguel Joint Union School District.
So what do you do as the food director at a school?
I do everything from help organize and plan the menus to staffing to nutrition education, and then a lot about procurement and purchasing food for the district. And we serve 600 or so students, kindergarten through eighth grade, and we do breakfast, lunch, and we just launched our supper program.
When you're sourcing food, don't you get everything from Sysco?
We could. That would be really easy, right? We do not. We try and source a lot of local foods, and that's where Claire comes in. We source everything from local bread from Edna's Bakery to protein from Molnar Cattle, local grass-fed beef, and then we work with Claire. Claire has around 20 farms that she works with, and we source up in North County from at least 12 of those farms.
Does the farmer just rock up in a big truck and drop off 10 deliveries a day?
Sometimes they do just show up when they have product, but most of the time we strategically order throughout when they have product in season. We sometimes will even collaborate with the districts close by to do like one large group order to help the farmer out, and then it helps us out too.
You're the middlewoman.
Yes, I am.
How did this come into being?
We started Farm to School in 2020 because we wanted to support small farmers to find more local buyers, because that's something that they struggle with in the county. And I figured out with the schools what they needed from farmers in terms of paperwork and regulations and certifications. And then I started sending information out to the schools about what farmers have and their pricing, and trying to coordinate deliveries and get everybody the information that they need.
What kind of farmers have the pre-wrapped burritos and dinosaur-shaped chicken nuggets?
None of our farmers have that. I deal mostly with our produce farmers and then a little bit with our ranchers. So we get everything from cilantro to carrots to 45 different kinds of apples one of our farmers grows. And then the farm that we're at today, Shanley Farms, grows finger limes and avocados, passion fruit, and a smattering of other rare fruits. Honey, they also have honey.
Do you have use for all of those products?
We do. We do a lot of scratch cooking. We also like to do a lot of different taste tests with the kids and expose them to their food system. So something like an avocado or a finger lime, they know what avocados are, but they might not know that those grow so close to where they go to school. And the finger limes are such a fun and unique fruit that those are super exciting. So there's some items that Claire mentioned, like apples that we use every single day, or cilantro that we can mix in, but there's other items that these farmers grow that we purchase just when they're in season as a specialty item for them to taste.
So I mentioned some processed foods. How much processed foods or pre-prepared foods are in your school district?
Try right now, we're sourcing at least 40% coming from locally sourced. And then from there, we really want to try and make sure all of our produce is California grown as much as possible.
So you're the farmer?
Yes, I'm the farmer here at Same. Shanley Farm. I'm Megan Warren, and we grow avocados, passion fruit, finger limes, some coffee. We even have some dragon fruit floating around. And we supply a whole range of customers, but our favorite customer is the local schools here in SLO County.
As a farmer, why would you do this? Because I'm assuming that San Miguel School District isn't just like a wash with cash. And so I'm assuming that you could probably get a better price even just at the farmer's market.
Farmer's markets require a lot of work on our part that we don't have the staffing for. I love working with schools because we end up getting paid market price. So if our produce, if I was going to sell to a normal distributor, they put a 50 to 100% markup on it, sometimes a 200% markup on it. And that's market price. When I go straight to schools, the farmer gets to keep the money. It's not going in everyone else's pockets. It's going into the farmer's pocket.
That's interesting. Yeah. I need to do a show on the economics of produce. Clearly.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
I only just learned this because my dad passed away and we started scraping at ways to from losing the farm. And that's about the time that we opened the doors to the schools and realized that they were allowing the farmers to keep their fair money.
Food service department and school districts, we're not trying to make a profit, right? Our goal is really to break even and to serve kids the best that's available. So when we can pay the farmers a really fair price, why wouldn't we do that?
Exactly. Speaking of the kids and feeding them good food, this program's been going for 4 years?
Yes.
And how long in the school district?
I started working for San Miguel School District about 3 years ago, and I brought that farm to school there when I started. I really got my experience from working with Erin Primer at San Luis Coastal School District, and I would say she's the one, and that district has really spearheaded the program in SLO County. And the state has really been pushing and been very supportive of farm to school. And I think COVID has really shown a light on the work that we do in schools, that kids need to eat good food and food service departments at school districts are important and this whole cycle. And so there's been a lot of support and a lot of push for farm to school across the state and across the country, really. But San Luis Obispo County, we're just so fortunate that we have so much available to us, so close to us. We have apples that are grown like a mile and a half maybe from our district. And I know that Shanley Farms is close to some of the schools in San Luis Coastal. So we just are really fortunate too.
Did you have trouble getting the kids to like locally sourced fresh produce?
Not at all. I take strawberries, for example. You show kids amazing strawberry that they've never tasted. They just get so excited that there's these vibrant pieces of fruits and vegetables that they have access to on their salad bars. And then they're more excited to eat meals at school. And then when you bring the farmers out, Shanley Farms has come out a few times and talked to the kids and say, hey, this is what we grow. Then the kids are like, where does this grow? What is this? How does it grow? Is that a job that we could do someday? And it creates this whole cycle that's just so amazing. They just get really excited about it.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian on a local farm that sells its produce to local schools. When I was a kid eating school lunches every day, ketchup was considered a vegetable, never mind that tomatoes are a fruit. The Farm to School program is making sure atrocities like that never happen again, and Megan from Shanley Farms is a part of that crusade.
You're a farmer. Can you show us some of the stuff that you send their way?
Yes, let me show you the way.
Okay.
Okay, these are passion fruit vines. My dad implemented this as part of his layered agriculture strategy. So you're planting several different crops that grow symbiotically on the same land. So you're getting multiple revenue streams off of one piece of land.
They also fruit at different times.
Right. Granted, it's all within the June through January timeframe. I would love a crop that fruited in the spring. That actually is what's gotten us bottling honey, is so we have a product in these off months to sell.
So you have a lot of avocado trees. Is that your main crop?
Avocados would be our main crop. However, our largest earning crop would be the finger limes. You squeeze it and all these teeny tiny little pearls start coming out. And this is what you would top your sushi with or add to a cocktail, to a cold beer. My kids love it on their tacos, but honestly, my kids just eat it like edamame, kind of squeeze it out and crunch the pearls.
Do the school kids put it on their margaritas?
When Shanley would come out to the schools, they'll bring avocados and finger limes. We have a tortilla chip and then we put a slice of avocado and then finger limes on top.
I love that.
And the kids love it. It's so good. It's so good.
And the kids look forward to tasting them every year. Most of them have all tasted them except for the kindergartners, but they go crazy. And then the whole classroom or wherever they're tasting them will smell like finger limes, and they'll just eat them, or they put them in, even in like vanilla yogurt as like a little sour sprinkle. It's really good.
One of the students from your school was obsessed, and his mom found us on Instagram because of a sticker that Claire had put on the package. And he came out here and I gave him a little tour, and he got to fill his own little package with finger limes. And it was like, I think, the happiest day of his little life.
Yeah,
it was. She said, my son is just obsessed. Is there any way you could do this for me? Because we're not open to the public yet. And I was just like, definitely, he loved it.
These like experiences that kids can have with local produce, that's what we want them to have so then they can grow up and continue to enjoy seasonality of produce, like learn about their food system. And as that progresses, then we have a generation of consumers that understand their food environment and the benefits for their health. That's why I love my job, because we are teaching kids and they're the ones that are going to be our future leaders. So why wouldn't we want to nourish them with the best possible produce?
We want to build an educational center for school kids to come visit the ranches. And I remembered in kindergarten, I grew up in Hanford, and we got to tour a dairy, and I saw the milk like dropping into these buckets, and I was taken for life. I ended up going and studying dairy science at Cornell University just because I was so taken by this dairy production. Granted, I didn't progress in that at all. I'm now an avocado and finger lime farmer.
Transferable skills.
Like, just as a young child, I was given such an understanding of where food comes from, and it carried with me forever.
So maybe you're creating a generation of kids who are going to de-mechanize our food system.
Yeah, let's hope.
Yeah.
It'd be awesome to see.
It's only been 3 years. What was it like for your fifth graders who then were eighth graders and then left?
I'm glad you asked this question, because this was the year I remember when I started. I told my staff, you know, the middle schoolers, they're not going to be into this, especially the older ones. But then 3 years later, we now have our oldest kids participating just as much as the younger students.
How does your kitchen sustain being able to make all this food?
A lot of what we do is scratch, but also speed scratch. We buy really great tamales that come frozen, so we'll heat those up, but then with it maybe we'll have avocado guacamole from Shanley Farm, or we'll make a homemade salsa. So there's multiple ways to loop it in without going fully scratch. That would be difficult. Like our pizza dough we'll make from scratch, and then we'll do sauce and the cheese. It's hard, but I think that it's worth it. And I think when my staff see the kids' reaction to the food, it makes the whole process worth it, and they'll do it again and again and again.
How difficult was it to start this program, and what was the motivation? Like, who started this program?
Well, we started it because we want to support small farmers. Like Lauren was saying, Erin Primer at San Luis Coastal, she was the one who spearheaded it. I worked with her really closely to understand what the schools need, and then I've just kind of rolled that out as I've been able to, and it's still developing. I mean, we're still setting up, you know, our standard procedures and things like that, but we've gotten a lot of support from the state. You know, they have a farm-to-school incubator grant program. We're using those funds to build more efficiency and make it more approachable for our small farmers. The farm farmers don't know all the processes that have to be followed for the school. So it's my job to outline that for them and do my best to set expectations of this is the standard paperwork that the schools need. And really aggregating that information about what is available is more simple for the school so that they know which farmers to go through to get their orders, because they place orders directly with our farmers. For the farmers, it's easier for them if I aggregate that information and send it out to multiple buyers who come directly to them, instead of them having to go to each buyer to say, this is what I have, and then repeat themselves like yes. 6 to 10 times.
Yes, Claire, you have made things so much easier from day one of this whole process on both sides, for sure.
There's no way that our district would have been able to support 12 different local farmers without that support, because there's lots of logistical information. And just like you mentioned in the beginning of when I'm buying from Sysco, I could buy everything from Sysco, but I don't want to. But it can be challenging to make those connections with a lot of other local purveyors. So to be able to have someone and a team that can bridge that gap is instrumental in the whole process.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and just had a tour of Shanley Farms, where avocados and finger limes are going straight from the tree to local school lunches, thanks to the Farm to School program that's revitalizing school lunches. Now, I'm personally going from farm to school to get the experience that the school children get at Lillian Larson Elementary School in San Miguel. Warning, the sound backdrop is the dulcet tones of school children. These are the kids who are eating the healthy meals that you're sourcing from local farms?
Yes.
So what are they eating today?
Today on the garden bar over there, we have some apples from Fairhill Farm, kumquats it seems, and the kumquats came from Feed Central Coast, which is the upcoming kind of food hub around Jicama, and some really yummy coleslaw, zucchini. The scratch-made cornbread has honey, and we purchased the honey from Alicia Taff at Just Juju Bees. And then we have some barbecue drumsticks over there. The drumsticks are not sourced locally, but if anyone's listening and anyone has a locally sourced chicken drumstick, I am very interested. And Edna's Bakery provides us bread for our sandwiches. They have a nice low-sugar muffins that we've been purchasing. They have cinnamon rolls. They do a wide variety of school food service.
My name is Susanna Palacios, and I am the food service lead here.
What's it like sourcing food from local farms for you?
I think it's great because the kids get to learn about what grows on our local farms, because we do have events where the farmers come out and bring their produce for the children. I think it's great that they're learning where their food is coming from, and they get to try new things that they haven't tried before, and more scratch cooking into the school too.
Is the scratch cooking though more work for you when you have how many kids?
We usually make about 430 meals a day. It is more work, but I think it's worth it, so the children aren't eating as much processed food.
How do the two of you work together?
Usually Lauren comes up with the menu items, and she's the one that sources everything. And then we do have a lot of menu testing, Lauren and I. So we try out new recipes, and we've been bringing a lot more new recipes for our children to try as well.
What are some of your new recipes?
Well, before I started working here, I guess it was all mostly heat and serve food. So we do the cornbread. We've started making our own muffins, our own pizza dough. We also have tried different coffee cake recipes for the children for breakfast. We've made pasta as well. And I think it's just been great adding more homemade food for the children.
When you're testing recipes, when are you able to do that?
Usually when it's a day where we're not making the whole meal from scratch and one or two of my other helpers in the kitchen can handle it on their own, that's when I get to make small batches of new recipes to see how they turn out, what we need to change, what tweaks we need to make. Because usually once we find a recipe, especially for the breakfast items like the muffins or coffee cake, we try to reduce the sugar as much as possible when still making it work. So that's why we need a recipe test.
And most of that stuff gets sourced locally?
We get our beef from a local farm for the ground beef and burger patties. Mostly right now it's been the fruit and vegetable. We haven't really had a lot of luck with any other proteins.
Thank you. I'm going to go try this meal now.
Thank you. Okay, two hands. There's a lot on here. I know. Two hands.
All right, so I'm going to try a school lunch. I haven't had a school lunch in a long time. Okay, I'm going to try this cornbread. This is a really big piece of cornbread.
Wow, look at that piece of chicken.
Never had it made with honey. Really good.
It has some buttermilk in it. We melt the honey with the butter. Alicia's honey is so flavorful.
What's the challenge in sourcing other proteins than beef from the local rancher? Is it that there's not chicken or pork grown here?
I think that there is chicken and pork grown here, but from what I've been gathering, there's very small producers. And for one meal, love lunch for drumsticks, for both sites, we probably need 800 drumsticks. And we are a very small district, so you could imagine when you scale up, even a local rancher may not have that many birds.
If you know a local poultry farmer, get in touch with Lauren. Now it was time to try more of the local produce.
Oh, we have a kumquat, and you're able to eat the whole thing. Only found out about this last year, because I was trying to peel it, and the teachers told me, no, you just put it in your mouth.
Really? I didn't know that. Do the kids eat them whole?
They love them. I always see them eating them.
I want to see them eat it whole.
Yeah, let's eat it together. All of it. Let's do it. Hector.
Yeah, I'll do it too.
I'll do it too. Ready?
Go.
The peel is what is kind of sweet, and then the inside is that sour punch.
He thinks it's a little sour.
It's sour.
Good though.
Just chew.
Go. Yeah.
It wasn't his favorite. Oh, he likes it. Yep. And then there was parent testimony.
My son goes to Cappy Culver, and I was working there for a while to help out, and just to see that they could pick what they want of fresh fruits and vegetables and everything's right there. It's a wonderful program. I really enjoy it.
I ate school meals every day from kindergarten to sixth grade and all through high school. And it was all super processed convenience food except at my high school where a very small amount was scratch made. In my lifetime, our food system has marched steadily toward fake food being the norm. Hopefully, with the help of farm to school programs, that will change. And with the help of school nutritionists like Lauren, farmers like Megan, and the organizers like Claire, the leaders who will make that change are being fed real food in school today. Here's Lauren to close.
I think just changing the perception of school lunch, getting rid of that stigma that it's gross and only for the neediest of kids, because that's not true anymore.
Yeah.
School lunch is for all kids. Universal Meals is not about feeding only the ones who need it the most, but just feeding kids good food in school so they can be nourished throughout the day, so they can have energy to play and brain power to learn. And I want to serve them what I'm going to eat for lunch. I eat school meals. My staff eat school meals. We have a lot of staff that eat meals at school, so why would we want to serve them something that we don't even want to eat ourselves?
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman. We're going to take a short break. When we return, you'll hear about recent changes for cruise ships visiting Santa Barbara and why it's important that some sea otters use tools. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Cruise ships in Santa Barbara have created controversy with city officials, residents, and environmentalists. UCSB student reporter Annabelle Hurst spoke with Ted Morton of Santa Barbara Channel Keeper about the changes the city recently set in place for visiting cruise ships.
On Tuesday, April 9th, the Santa Barbara City Council voted 6-1 to limit the number of cruise ships that are allowed to visit Santa Barbara each year to 20. They also put in place several protocols to prioritize ships with pollution prevention technology. Concerns were initially raised in the Santa Barbara community about the number of ships visiting and their environmental impact in 2022, when a record high of 30 ships visited. Then, the Santa Barbara Channel Keeper brought the issue to the city and requested a public assessment of the city's cruise ship program, sparking 2 years of discussion between community members, environmental organizations, and the City Harbor Commission. To learn more about the new protocols and the process behind the council's decision, I spoke with Ted Morton of Santa Barbara Channel Keeper.
My name is Ted Morton, and I'm the executive director of Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. So Santa Barbara Channel Keeper is a conservation organization. We started as a program of the Environmental Defense Center in 1999, and we became our own group in 2001. Our mission is to protect and restore the Santa Barbara Channel and its watersheds. We work from Point Conception down to Ventura River and from the mountains out to the Channel Islands. And our primary focus is on water quality and ensuring healthy habitats. We run a number of programs, educational programs, volunteer programs. We do field work. We are advocates. And if we feel like it's necessary, we also will hire attorneys to help us enforce environmental laws.
You mentioned that Channel Keeper, you guys initially asked the Santa Barbara City to conduct the public assessment of the cruise ship program. Could you talk a little bit about why Channel Keeper requested that initial look into it?
Yeah, absolutely. So during COVID, there were restrictions for cruise ships. So for a good part of 2020 and 2021, there were no cruise ships that were visiting Santa Barbara due to the COVID public health restrictions. So in 2022, cruise ships began to return to the city of Santa Barbara. And we were concerned about the number of ships that were scheduled. So it was, 30 ships, which was an all-time high for the number of cruise ships coming to Santa Barbara. And we received a lot of phone calls from concerned citizens as well about the impact of cruise ships. We are concerned about the risk to the very special marine environment that's out there in the channel, and also the public health concerns for air quality, water quality within our community. So we asked the city to take a time to just gather public input on the cruise ship program and help the public shape the future of the cruise ship program through their ideas and their perspectives. This was the first time, from our understanding, that the city had ever done this, a public engagement opportunity to hear from the community about what they liked, disliked about the cruise ship program moving forward. So we asked the city to initiate this review, and we were very happy to see that they took us up on it. It really sort of kicked off in April of 2022. So it's been over the last 2 years that there have been opportunities for the public to participate in meetings to share their thoughts and ideas about the future of the cruise ship program here in Santa Barbara.
Could you talk more about the environmental risks that people were concerned about?
Cruise ships are like many little cities that are floating out in the water, and they transit the ocean and they visit very special, beautiful places. And so they generate a lot of waste, and something needs to be done with that waste. And cruise ships are allowed to dump untreated sewage, gray water, bilge water, once they're 12 miles off of shore. They can do that, or there's some larger port facilities where they can offload some of that sewage as well. But the law sort of gives them that allowance to dump offshore. So there were a lot of concerns about the water quality impacts, particularly offshore, and what does that mean to our marine environment? Also, there were concerns about air quality and the emissions. The air emissions contain nitrogen oxide, sulfur oxide, greenhouse gases. And, you can see the cruise ships when they're anchored offshore, they're running auxiliary engines And so they're still burning fuel and emitting air emissions that have those contaminants, and then also particulate matters as well that can cause smog and cause harm to the public health. There was also concern about the impacts of the traffic and the noise to marine mammals, also the potential for striking marine mammals if the ships are going too fast through the channel. And then there were a lot of concerns about just the contributions that cruise ships have to climate change and increased greenhouse gases.
Could you talk about what recommendations that you guys recommended to the city council after all the discussion?
Channel Keeper put together a set of recommendations based on what we were hearing from the community members and from our research as well. The first recommendation we had was to reduce and cap the annual number of cruise ships visiting Santa Barbara. And we chose the number 18 as the hard cap. We chose that because that was the average number of cruise ships that visited Santa Barbara between 2010 and 2019. It was sort of an attempt to sort of go back to some like more historic trends as compared to what we were seeing happening in 2022. And then also concerns that that could be a sign of the future and that the program could just grow more and more. So we wanted to set that cap to prevent the further expansion of cruise ships and have greater certainty among the community. We also wanted requirements that the cruise ships that do come to Santa Barbara use advanced wastewater treatment systems. So this is new technology that's come on board primarily in the last 20 years, and about 77% of the ships worldwide have this technology in place. And so we wanted a requirement for that to just reduce the risk of wastewater pollution and the impacts. Also request that ships actually slow down while they're coming into Santa Barbara Harbor to minimize the potential of striking a whale and also reducing noise and air emissions. And then also, you know, prioritize those ships that do come in among those ships that are committed to installing technology that prevents air and water pollution and also have good environmental compliance records.
If you're just joining us, Annabelle Hurst of UC Santa Barbara's student-run radio station KCSB is speaking with Ted Morton of Channel Keeper about cruise ships in Santa Barbara.
The city then decided 20 ships annually and then also a couple of the other recommendations. Could you talk about what environmental protections that they, accepted or the recommendations that they went through with?
Sure. So in addition to the cap, they also required the ships to have this advanced wastewater treatment system on board. They required that ships that come through the channel do slow down to 10 knots or less. They actually asked the Harbor Commission and the Waterfront Department staff to do more work in establishing a set of best practices that cruise ships are using and looking at scorecards and other data to develop a list to prioritize those ships with some of that best technology. And they also maintained a working group of harbor commissioners to work with the waterfront staff on putting more detail in some of these recommendations that needed a little bit more work. So there's still an opportunity there that we see for the public potentially to continue to be engaged in the program and sharing their ideas. The city also agreed to a couple of other things. These weren't really from our set of recommendations, but the city staff decided to increase the passenger fees. So when a cruise ship comes, they pay the city for the privilege of visiting us and for the services that we provide to them. And so they increased that passenger fee to help cover some of the cost. And then also they formalized their existing agreement that there would be no cruise ships during the summer months and then also no cruise ships visiting on weekends.
Do you see any other like major things being put in place?
It's still to be determined. So this happened, the city council vote was on April the 9th. And so we're still trying to determine sort of what is the city staff going to be doing, sort of what is their process for doing this further work that the city council asked them to do. I should also say one of the other parts of the discussion at the city council meeting was thinking about the size of the ships that come in. So looking at how could we give prioritization or give preferences to smaller ships that should have, you know, a less of an environmental impact. So I think it's a little too early to tell exactly how much more needs to be done. You know, that whole kind of process of like looking at what kind of best practices that we want the ships to be undertaking, that still needs to be developed. I think that through the recommendations and the discussions that we had through the two-year process, those have been identified. And then I think there are ways to just gather that information. So I hope that it doesn't require a whole lot of more time and more effort to get the fine details on that. But we're hoping that, you know, within the next 6 months, we can sort of really have a good look at what those, how does that prioritization look like? What kind of technologies we would like to see the ships that come here have installed.
So then throughout this process, I know there are also other Santa Barbara environmental groups like the Environmental Defense Center that were engaged. Could you discuss like the cooperation or collaboration that went on, the other groups that were involved?
Channel Keeper, we set up a listserv for people who are interested, including some of the representatives from the other organizations. So we were trying to just keep people apprised of when the public meetings were occurring, what was on the agenda. And we worked early on in the process with a number of individuals that were associated with the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary. So they have an advisory council, and it's made up of government agency representatives, scientists, representatives of like user groups like fishermen, or you know, tourism operators and environmental groups, to pull together a letter with some recommendations that were sort of the early part of sort of what we worked on. And then when we got closer to the actual meetings of the Harbor Commission and the City Council, we worked on a joint letter that we all signed on to and submitted as part of the official record. So it was Channel Keeper and Environmental Defense Center and CEC and the Surfrider chapter and others that were showing solid support for recommendations to improve the program. They encouraged their members to weigh in with letters of their own, you know, emails to the City Council and letting them know of the opportunities to show up and give testimony at the City Council meeting and the Harbor Commission meeting.
This was then the first time that the city has done like that procedure with the community members and the cruise ships. Do you see that same method being used with environmental changes in the future?
Yeah, I think it's a good prototype or a good process. I think always giving the public an opportunity to sort of weigh in is good, sound civic leadership. It does require work. I mean, someone has to set it up and set the process up and sort of take the notes and sort of move it through. But I think it's a process that's worth thinking about to replicate.
All this in mind, all the changes to the cruise ship program, how do you see then the comings and goings of cruise ships in Santa Barbara?
Well, I think for community members who are concerned, we at least have a cap. We have a certain number that they're going to be 20, and we think that that will help reduce the risk to the environment. You know, we think that by implementing these recommendations, we're making sure that the ships that do come into Santa Barbara are using the best technology. We're also taking steps to minimize the risk and doing more to protect the environment and protect the public health. And also, I think just demonstrating that once again, Santa Barbara a civic leader in conservation. So we're trying to sort of push the envelope with the industry to say, hey, you know, we want to make sure that you're doing all that you can do even more than what you're doing to protect the environment.
Is there anything else that you think is important that we haven't hit on yet?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say that we applaud the Santa Barbara City Council and the Harbor Commission for really listening to the community and their points of view and taking important steps to align the city's cruise ship program with the environmental priorities of the city and the community members. So we think that was a really positive step, that it was sort of, you know, community action, and there was a reward for that the City Council and the Harbor Commission listened and followed through with what they were hearing from the community members.
That was Ted Morton with Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. For more information about Santa Barbara Channel Keeper, you can visit sbck.org. With KCSB News, I'm Annabelle Hurst.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangerman. Have you seen this? Sea otters using rocks as tools? Sometimes an otter will float on its back with a big rock on its belly. It can then smash clams and other hard food into the rock to get at the tasty bits inside. Sometimes, if the ocean is quiet, you can hear them too. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports that using tools seems to help some otters survive in an ocean that's changing.
Sea otters frolic off the coast of California, and biologist Chris Law says they eat several different kinds of seafood.
Their preferred prey are usually urchins and abalone.
These favorite snacks are high calorie and relatively easy to eat. But in places where lots of otters live together, competing for food.
Unfortunately, all those prey items have been declining or have declined. So these otters have to eat alternative foods.
Foods with hard shells, clams, crabs, and snails, which are abundant but super hard. Otters can use rocks and even trash like glass bottles to help break them open. But otters really vary in whether and how often they use tools.
So we were interested in this tool use variation. Do these different prey items require different amounts of tool use? And what are the actual advantages to break into those different prey items?
Law is with the University of Texas and the University of Washington. He teamed up with some colleagues to analyze data on nearly 200 otters in California. These otters have been tagged, and they get closely monitored by volunteer otter spotters.
So we have information on, like, you know, where they are, how old they are, what they're eating, even estimate the size of prey they're eating, and whether they're using tools associated with those different prey items.
It turns out that frequent tool users were able to eat harder and larger prey. This was really important for female otters. They're smaller than males.
They have weaker biting ability, and they typically wouldn't be able to break into harder prey, but they use tools more than males, so they're able to gain access to these novel sources of food items.
What's more, using tools to open prey protected otters' teeth. Tool users had less dental damage. That's a big deal because an otter with bad teeth can't really eat anything. Law says tool users can resort to lots of low-calorie prey when their preferred foods are increasingly unavailable. A report on the findings is in the journal Science.
This is such an important paper.
Rob Shoemaker is the president and CEO of the Indianapolis Zoo and one of the authors of a book called Animal Tool Behavior.
Sea otters are one of the foundational examples of tool use in non-humans, so super important and incredibly well documented, even since the 1960s.
Decades have been spent just cataloging examples of tool use in animals. He says now researchers are starting to go a step further.
And this paper is a great example. It's not about describing the actual tool use or tool manufacture anymore. It's describing the impact that it has on that animal's life.
He says dozens of species use tools, everything from octopuses to crows to chimps. So there's lots more to study to see the different ways that tools might help an animal get by in a changing world. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.